This call will now be recorded.
Would you like to open the call?
Okay, so let's get started. This is Margie Milam. We're here to talk about the URS, and John Nevitt will be chairing the call. He can't get on the for him. And then Gisela, do you want to take a roll?
Absolutely. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On today's STI URS, Tuesday, 24 November, we have Zahid Jamil, Wendy Seltzer, Mark Partridge, Jeff Eckhaus, Olivier Crépin-Leblanc, Paul McGrady, John Nevitt, Kathy Kleinman, Mike Rodenbach, Konstantinos Komaitis, Alan Greenberg. From staff, we have Margie Milam, Amy Statos, Liz Gaster, Marika Konings, and apologies, we have David Maher and Jeff Newman. If I could also please remind everyone to state their names for transcript purposes. Thank you. Back to you, Margie.
Thank you. I sent around earlier, and John, I think you should probably have it in your email, the URS strawman proposal updated to reflect the notes from the last call. I sent it out about an hour ago. So, John, I don't know.
I have it. Does everyone have that?
No one has that.
Yes.
Great. So we have that up right now in the Adobe Connect room, and I thought probably the best thing to do would be to start where we didn't finish. We didn't finish the last 2 points, and then go back and revisit the conclusions and the notes that I've circulated. I think that's probably the best way to approach this.
One housekeeping, actually two housekeeping items. I read the transcript of the last call, and Paul McGrady is Paul Diaz in the transcript, so we should update that. And then also just a reminder that everyone say their name, at least in the beginning, because there's a couple of spots in the transcript where it just says man said something. So I wasn't sure who the man was.
It's all by evil plans to for there to be no historical or evidentiary record of me being involved in this.
Can we all say that?
No fingerprints.
Okay.
So abusive process is the one we left off on?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. So the proposal is two abusive complaints or one finding of a perjury barred or perjury. You would be the entity or the person would be barred for 1 year from the URS, and then three or more complaints against a panelist that are overturned by appeal. They lose their accreditation to serve as a panelist or examiner, I think we're calling it now. And then, we left it to staff to implement guidelines of what constitutes abuse. And that's a little different than the staff proposal. The default proposal is if there's an abusive complaint on three occasions, you're barred for 1 year. So based on some of the comments, we took that down by one.
It's Alan. Can I get in?
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm happy to leave the details for staff implementation. It would be good to have some level of either provide them with guidance or they come back with a quick straw man, because the issue of who decides and how do we measure abuse is critical to the success of this, at least from the point of view of people who are worried that the IP holders, the trademark holders, some of them may be inclined to be more something obstreperous than one imagines they will be. So it would be good to have some input into how that's going to be managed, not just assume the sky will open up and the gods will give us a definition of abuse that we're all happy with.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say Kathy has her hand raised.
Yeah, great, thanks.
Thanks, Kathy Kleinman. I think overall it's a good summary. With perjury, At least as originally proposed, and I'm kind of getting some of the drafts confused. Excuse me. I think with perjury, it was much more than a year. I think as originally proposed, it was you're out of the URS process. If you've abused it with by lying to the tribunal, you don't get to come to this tribunal again. Of course, perjury in, say, U.S. courts, perjury would be treated, you know, with even higher sanctions. So I wanted to propose that as a much more significant penalty for perjury.
Mark Partridge.
Well, I'll take off on what Kathy said. I think perjury might be a workable standard. I'm not sure it's the same around the world, and we need to be clear that we're not just saying a factual mistake or something along those lines, but it's a deliberate intent to deceive the process. As far as standards for what abuse would be, I suggest that one of the places where we could look would be in the UDRP cases where there's been a finding of abuse. There are reported decisions. I've written at least one, maybe two, where that's happened, and so we've got that to work from.
I understand Jeff Eckhouse has his hands up.
Yeah, thanks. So I just had a question. Can we just take a step back and say where, I guess, the separation or why, where we're not on consensus either, so what the gap is between, I guess, the what we have on the straw man here. I guess maybe on the straw man or what the separation is, because I'm just a little confused. I know people are throwing out what some of their thoughts are, but where the separation is and what we're trying to bridge here, is that possible?
Sure. There are three.
Or not you or somebody else could. I don't know. I'm volunteering you as
yeah,
chair.
But there are three issues here. There's the number of abusive complaints that one has to engage in order to have some kind of sanction. The second one is, and then there's a subpart to that, is do you look at that based on abusive complaints first, one of outright lying, and is there a different sanction for the two? And then, is there kind of abusive discretion on behalf of a panelist or an examiner that we're looking at as well? So, there's the IRT recommendation, which, set one standard. There's Kathy just mentioned that she had a proposal that had another level of number of complaints, and then the staff had one, and then we tried to amalgamate that and come up with something that we thought was a workable compromise. So that's what's being discussed now.
Yeah.
So if I would look at it, let's look at the abusive complaints on behalf of a complainant, and should we have two standards, one for some kind of outright lying with intent to deceive the panel or the examiner versus just being abusive in that, there was no leg to stand on and they filed the complaint anyway and had the registrant and responded and incur the time and resources of responding.
Okay, well, thanks. So I guess my question is, thanks for that. That was very good. So this is Jeff, by the way, still talking. So my thought is, I'm not a lawyer here, but maybe the people, I'm assuming almost everyone else here is, to say, some of the thoughts and ideas are if they're lying or if it's abusive, can that be proven or who's the person to decide that, to make that happen? I'm just wondering, are we setting a goal saying, okay, if this person is lying or if it's abusive, but is it possible, how difficult is that for it to be, proven, or how does that happen for that decision to be made so that we're making these judgments saying two abusive or three abusive, or is it almost impossible to get somebody to be named abusive, I guess is my next question.
Mark, do you want to take that from your UDRP experience?
Well, I will say it's not impossible to have a finding that the complaint was abusive. There's a difference between being abusive and losing, of course. And there's far more situations where people have lost, but it hasn't been an abuse.
normally in the UDRP, the panelist is the one who makes the decision based on the record that gets submitted.
Any hands up?
Amy has her hand up, and then Wendy, and then Paul, and then Kathy. We've got a long queue here.
Great.
Hi, this is Amy. Just a quick question on the proposal with respect to complaints from a complainant. Are we talking about an individual entity or related entities, or what was the group contemplating on that?
As far as the complainant?
It says two complaints, two abusive complaints.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a complaint from a single entity or related entities, say one's a parent of a sub, or was there a contemplation of that?
We certainly didn't discuss that, find a detail on for this proposal, but I would think you would use the same. In the IRT report, we talked about when an entity could file a complaint together or separately. So you might want to think about the same level of standard for that. Meaning if Time Warner had a complaint and it was for HBO versus, you know, Time Warner Cable versus Turner Network or something like that, are those related or not? And I think there was a standard in the IRT report for that.
Okay, I'll take that.
Do you remember, Mark, what the specifics were?
We didn't address the exact question from Amy's point of view, but I think it would be difficult to say to go into related companies. You don't know if the companies are related, and often related companies really don't have any common, a common voice. They operate as independent operators, so the abuse would be by a particular party filing the case.
Yes, this is Konstantinos. Just on this very topic, and sorry to be jumping in, but I agree with Mark. It would be very unfair, I think, even considering how many distribution agreements are out there, as well as to bar one company and its secondary or franchises completely simply because one trademark owner has abused the system. So I would agree with Mark on that.
Okay. Let me go back to anyone else on that specific point. Otherwise, I'll go back to the main queue. All right, I got Wendy, and then Paul and Kathy.
Wendy, I just want to agree with Mark's suggestion that allowing the panelists to determine abuse seems like a good solution. So two separate categories of either abuse or finding someone who's perjured themselves. Good reasons to bar them from reusing the process.
Okay. Paul?
Hi, sorry about pushing the lock button when I mean to be pushing the unmute button. I apologize. I think that we should, in terms of perjury, it's an interesting concept, and I just wanted to have some clarification on the folks who suggest from the folks who suggested it. I mean, perjury is generally it's a criminal, and so are we talking about, you know, in the event somebody is convicted of crime? Or are we saying perjury that means lesser than that?
I mean, Kathy, do you want to respond? You're the one who proposed it. I could tell you what I was thinking when I put it in this proposed straw man.
I'll tell you what, why don't you start and I'll follow up. Apologies for the cold here.
Okay. It certainly wasn't I don't think these would be under rules of perjury, certainly from U.S. Legal standpoint. So it would be, I think Mark referred to it before, some kind of intentional lying to the examiner, and obviously there would be a level of proof associated with that intentional act.
A way you might phrase it would be deliberate material falsehood.
Sounds good to me.
I'll agree with that. That makes a lot of sense, Kathy. So a deliberate intent to receive, lying to the examiner, deliberate material falsehood. Paul, does that do it?
I think it it's more clear that what we're talking about in that situation is that the panelists involved, or I suppose an appeal body, is empowered to reach that. Otherwise, we end up in a situation where somebody who has had an abusive complaint filed against them would have to essentially get local law enforcement involved in order to reach a perjury conviction. Or in the alternative, we could see a good faith actor who was filing good faith complaints, but each time he did that, an abusive respondent, perhaps in a, shall we say, less, well, I'll just go ahead and say it, in a more corrupt jurisdiction, you know, a good faith complainer may find himself constantly trying to send off perjury charges in a more corrupt jurisdiction. And so I just, from my point of view, bringing the criminal authorities into all this, even by accident, by, you know, would be a bad outcome. So that's a long-winded way of saying, yes, I think what Mark suggested would be great.
Great. Thanks, Paul. Kathy.
I wanted to comment also on the abusive complaint. Would it, some of the things that I was thinking of in terms of this were, there have been findings of reverse domain name hijacking. Increasingly, there's kind of a concept of trademark lawyer abuse of when the process has been abused. Would it be useful, or would anyone want to come up with some examples of these kinds of things? Probably going through UDRP cases.
Anyone think that would be useful?
It's Mike Rodenbaugh. I don't think that's particularly useful because all of those examples are going to be based on the specific facts of those cases. You know, it's not very helpful to just create a list.
Okay.
I don't see why we need them anyway, and the standard, I think, is clear enough under the UDRP. There's been dozens of decisions finding reverse domain name hijacking.
Okay, any other comments on that? Margie, any other hands up? I'm still trying to get in.
No.
Okay. So the next topic is the review of the URS and UDRP. We'll take a cue on that topic.
Constantino's raised his hand, and Alan as well.
I was just about to call him.
Yes, this is Constantinos. I think, and NCSG feels very strongly about it, that we need to proceed to a review of the UDRP for the simple reason that we're about to create a system, the URS, for those rapid cases, but we depend heavily on the UDRP. And the UDRP has been in operation for the past 10 years, and it hasn't undergone a substantial amendment. So considering the fact that we're about to launch something whereby we're using much of its justification on the UDRP, and we're using the experience of the UDRP, and much of our wording derives from the UDRP, I think that it would be beneficial to also request for a deep review and amendment, if necessary, for that matter, of the UDRP.
Okay, Howard?
A couple of things. Although I agree the UDRP needs a review, if we are intending to incorporate whatever the URS is in the final product of the UDRP review, in other words, to collapse them both into the same thing, we may well want some experience with the URS before we start that review. So that's point number one. I strongly support a set of reviews built into the URS to ensure that it is meeting the intent when we're setting it up. I think to do that, we are going to need to define some metrics to how to recognize success, number one. Number two, there's a problem of something that we've never addressed in ICANN, and that is, how do we modify a policy without going back and starting a PDP process from scratch, other than, you know, the emergency provisions within the bylaws for the board to take action. And it's something that we're going to be discussing as we rewrite the PDP rules over the next N months. But I think it's something we have to factor in. If indeed we do a review after 6 months or a year and find out that the URS is not working well and it needs tweaking, even if everyone agrees, what would the process be to actually do that? And I think we need to think about it just a little bit. Otherwise, putting up a request for a review without knowing how do we handle if we find, you know, how do we handle the outcome of that review is going into a little bit blind.
Okay, any comments on that?
Yeah, it's Jeff Eckhouse. I think I was up next, and I'm finding myself saying this almost every week. My comment was completely in agreement with Alan, which is, what are the remedies? What are the judgments? Is it going to be just thumbs up or thumbs down? They're doing a good job, you're doing a bad job. And if a decision on a bad job is there, is what are the remedies? What are the decisions? Just to say we're going to have a review, that's great, but is the person doing the review going to have, is it going to have teeth to be able to do anything? Because if there's no teeth to it, then I'll say, then let's just say, all right, then let's just push this one by because it doesn't even matter, actually, if there's a review or not, if there's no remedies available to whoever's doing the review.
Just a follow-on, John?
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah. I don't think we have the time to flesh this out right now, but I think it has to be identified as a critical issue in putting forward the whole URS process, that there be some ability to adjust it as we go along, if indeed that's found to be necessary. We need to acknowledge that it's a problem that we've never addressed in ICANN, and we have to somehow build it into this one, even if we don't come up with a solution today.
Okay, I've got Mark, Kathy, and Paul.
Yeah, I was just going to express the view that I think the issue of having a review of the UDRP is a complicated one. I think as to what the nature of that review is and how it goes forward, and it seems to me to be outside the scope of what our project is here. I think focusing on the URS is the right thing for this group.
Okay. Kathy and Paul. Kathy and then Paul.
Just making a note here. We had proposed, NCSG had proposed a sunset, which it may be worth revisiting for a second here. A sunset for the URS, not to stay the URS, not to suddenly have it suspended, but to really kind of force the review of the URS and the UDRP. I think just trying to go back to what the reasoning was of that, it was the concept of integration, of integration of the URS and the UDRP. What we're doing here is a little stilted. I mean, we're creating a new process where some people, like John Berryhill and Paul Keating, have commented that rather than a whole new URS, some tweaks to the UDRP might be a faster, more efficient way to get to many of the same results. So we're creating two parallel processes that really probably should be part of the same whole. So if we have the concept of a sunset, it forces that review. Have we gotten the URS right, and should the URS be better integrated with the UDRP? So I'd like to put back kind of a two-year or a three-year sunset into the concept, into the framework.
Any comments on the sunset? Paul?
Yeah, the sunset issue is essentially the same issue of what we've been talking about in terms of do we have the vision right now to write out the criteria for success of the URS? Do we have the vision right now to write out, the kinds of tweaks we might see coming down the path? And in essence, we have to ask ourselves, and I think the answer is no, I'll tell you up front, that, are we really the group that's designed to, in essence, bind the review process in the future? Do we see it all now? Do we see all the issues now? Or is the review process the exact opposite, which is we don't see all the issues now? We need a robust review process, but reaching conclusions, for example, in advance, like the URS needs to be sunsetted, or here are our personal views of the indications of success of the URS, I think really short circuits a true, open, honest, and helpful review process. I think instead that we should put these things down as dicta, right? We can say, you know, this is only for whoever takes up the review. Here are the things that we think, you know, we didn't reach consensus on these, but here is a list of what the STI thought, various members of the STI thought would be indications of success. Here are the potential outcomes that the various members of the STI suggested. You know, one is sunsetting. But to reach those conclusions in advance of the review, I think really does injustice to the notion of a review.
Okay, I've got Alan.
ICANN seems to love setting targets for itself, which are impossible to meet. And when things of the, you know, all organizations must be reviewed every 3 years, where the GNSO if we followed that rule and it was still around, we would have to be doing another review before the new council got seated. I think it's clear that ultimately the UDRP has to be reevaluated. The world changes around it, and we need to make sure it still meets our needs and it's adjusted based on what we found out over the last 10 years. The URS probably will become part of that if we do it in a proper way, but I think that's a different issue, and I think that's beyond our scope right now to mandate or to set what the timeline is for it. On the other hand, saying we're building a URS, which we're, to be honest, doing on the fly, trying to reach consensus, we may be making some stupid decisions, and we acknowledge that and want to make sure that we build in a correction process, I think is part of our mandate. Sunsetting I don't agree with, because I think it sets arbitrary timelines which we're not in a position to enforce or even set realistically, but making sure the URS is robust enough to live as long as it needs to live I think is important.
So how would you word a position on that, on this issue? You don't like the sunset, you think there should be a UDRP review and a URS review?
The URS needs to be reviewed every 6 months, and we need to set some metrics, or some metrics need to come out of the implementation of it to recognize whether it is basically working or not. And
what kinds of metrics are you talking about? Like numbers of cases?
Number of cases decided for and against. You know, for instance, we keep on talking about, you know, words like, you know, these are obvious cases of abuse. They're slam dunk. If we find out 2/3 of them are rejected, we have a problem. And I'm not saying that's going to happen, but that's an example of, from my point of view, an obvious metric.
Why is that a problem?
Because we designed it on the assumption that they were so obvious that most of them are going to be decided in favor of the complainant. And I think that's one of the premises of the whole process.
Well, if there's aggressiveness on behalf of the plaintiff, on behalf of the complainants, and they don't win, then and why is that? I guess I'm not following why that's an issue.
Okay. Maybe that isn't one of the ones we can agree on. I would have thought it was one. I think that's part of the discussion. We need to recognize what is it which is going to indicate to any of us that it's not working the way we envisioned it.
Right. I've got Wendy and then Mark.
So I'm going to agree that ICANN is not good at dealing with its deadlines effectively, and that's, to my mind, one of the things that a sunset does is it's a forcing function. It says, this is going to end unless it's either reviewed and found to be so effective that it should continue or changed into something that works better. So I do think a sunset is a useful tool to build in there, As Kathy was saying earlier, I think because we're designing this as a fix for things that we found broken about the UDRP, I think it makes sense and is in scope to tie together the reviews to suggest that what we really think should happen is a review of the generalized trademark protection mechanisms and conclusion about how they all are working together.
I've got Mark Partridge.
I was just going to support what Alan said. I think his approach is makes good sense on the metrics. One of the things to keep in mind in the whether people win or lose is that in a substantial number of cases, not all the information can be known to the complainant, and they may make good faith conclusions about the merits of their case at the start, but nevertheless lose. So it's very tricky to set a metric on how many cases should be decided one way or another within a dispute resolution system.
Paul, did you change your mind, or still?
Mark said it.
Okay. So let me ask a question. Other than it sounds like the NCSG is pushing for the sunset, that was certainly in the proposal. Any other members of the team other than NCSG support the concept of a sunset of the URS, or is it more of a mandatory review process?
Okay. Mike Rodenbaugh.
Mike?
Speaking, sorry, I'm not really using the Adobe Connect hands up thingy because I'm on a laptop and that would cause me to have to switch back and forth a lot. I think, you know, speaking personally, I could be in favor of a sunset provision if we give this thing some more teeth. I mean, right now where we're at with the lack of consensus on the transfer issue in particular makes it seem to me like this thing is just not going to be used by anybody. Essentially, we're working on a worthless solution. But if people are willing to negotiate and give it some teeth, I'd be willing to have a sunset provision, I think, as long as there's, you know, specific goals that are identified in advance as to what we are all intending for this to do, so we don't have to have that fight 3 or 4 years from now.
Okay. Just to respond to that, you know, the IRT recommended this process with a takedown without a transfer. So if the panel of trademark lawyers that served on that recommended that, I'm not sure if it's they felt that was worthless. But I take your point.
Compromise, right?
I've got hands up from Wendy and Alan. Was that from before, or is that new?
Alan is new.
Okay, go ahead, Wendy, and then Alan.
I said nothing from me, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Okay, then Alan and Mark?
Yeah, I was just going to support what Mark said, that it is difficult understanding what the metrics should be, and I was suggesting metrics not to say there's a problem, but to say what we need to look at it in more detail.
And Mark?
I'm sorry, I meant to take my hand down.
Okay, I see a microphone next to couple, Marika, is that something? All right.
Kathy? No, that's all right.
Okay.
John, I don't know why the microphone is coming up, but it seems to be popping up when
some administrator turns it on for you.
Oh, okay. I wanted to support Alan's idea of the review of the metrics of. If we require that the metrics be created at certain times every 6 months, as he proposes, then we know they will be run, and I think that will be very important analysis as we go forward.
Okay. All right. Any last points on this? Because we're you know 40 minutes in, we can start at the top now. Okay. Kathy, that's from before.
Sorry, my hand is down now.
Okay. So why don't we just start at the top of the proposal? It sounds like, just to recap on the URS-UDRP, everyone seems to be in favor of some kind of review. The question is what kind of metrics and what kind of review process would we use, and there does not appear to be consensus for a sunset. Okay. Mandatory, there was consensus. Elements of the complaint, consensus, but need examples.
Wait, wait, wait. John, can we go back to mandatory?
Sure.
There's consensus, again, with NCSG, provided that there's a fair process and balance and appeal, and this also has to do with the forum shopping issue.
Right.
Thanks.
Sure. So caveat of consensus. Elements of the complaint. So the proposal was same elements found in the UDRP, and then I guess Kathy and Constantinos, do you want to talk about the document you sent around?
Absolutely. Constantinos, do you want to start?
Do you want me to pull it up? I have it. It's not redlined, though. For some reason, when I converted it, it doesn't didn't show the redlining, but if it's useful to have it, I'll go ahead and put it up.
Sure.
Okay, Constantinos dropped, so Kathy, if you could take the lead.
Okay. What we have here, and apologies for sending it out so late, and, you know, if everyone wants to discuss it at a next meeting, that would certainly make sense. What we went through was an evaluation, as we requested, of what it was that we thought would be the elements of a clear-cut abusive registration. And we started with the UDRP, of course. It's the right place to start. And then just went through where the two kinds of things. One, where the UDRP, we think, is ambiguous to begin with. And the other, just really narrowing it down to specific circumstances that are easily provable, quickly provable, kind of the slam dunk kind of situations that have been part of the examples that we've been talking about in my involvement since Sydney. So with under applicable disputes, we have – Constantinos, are you back online?
Yes, just for that, I am back.
Okay, please participate and add as we go through.
Yes.
Do you want to walk through this, Constantinos?
No, you have already started. Let me see where
okay.
you are, and I will take it on later.
For applicable disputes, we took it to your domain name is identical. The process of proving a domain name is confusingly similar is a difficult process, a time-consuming process in some cases. And also looking through the forms of the IRT, it looked like the form of the complaint in number 10, that the IRT was envisioning a trademark that was identical to the domain name. And, of course, identical is now identical writ large, where you have the spaces and the underlines and the characters, like the ampersand, that have been either typed out or replaced with an undersign or something like that. And we can certainly put that in more expressly. Then in the administrative proceeding, the complainant must prove with evidence. I think that just makes sense, but it's kind of a signal to the complainant, you know, produce some evidence that each of these three elements are present. Don't just assert this. And then we're writing in evidence of clear-cut abusive registration because that's the purpose of the URS. We've changed panelist to URS examiner, consistent with one of the changes we talked about in the last meeting, to make it clear what proceeding we're in. And again, kind of repeating as I go through B, repeating the clear-cut abuse. A Roman numeral i, we're talking here about a significant number of domain names. One of the things we heard a lot about in Sydney and in Seoul was serial cyber squatting. So this is really codifying the serial cyber squatting concept and the practice of registering these names primarily for the purpose of selling them back at a high price. Which is something you know, no one likes. Roman numerals in small 2, we've got the case where you're trying to prevent the owner of a trademark from reflecting the mark in a corresponding domain name. And we've added, provided your use is not to criticize or comment on the trademark owner. And this came to mind to me yesterday when I was watching our national news here. There's just been a recall of 2 million cribs. We've had 15 children badly hurt, some killed just recently, and it's a joint recall of Canada and the United States Consumer Protection Commissions. And you can bet if my child were one hurt, I would register every variation of that trademark owner's website and put up as many warnings as possible to parents so that those cribs would get off the market. So that's kind of the concept that we're trying to to do here. And, of course, the idea would be to try to get in the way of that commercial commerce. In this case, it's already been recalled. But had the cribs not been recalled, I would have wanted to spread the news of that.
How would that work if you were a competitor of that crib company?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to defer that to somebody like Mark and Paul. That's a good one. And three, trying to, again, signal to the complainant that, you know, here's the evidence we need. This is supposed to be a rapid review. So if you're trying to show that someone has registered a domain name primarily for the purpose of disrupting your business, again, you don't want the non-commercial people. That's under freedom of expression. So it's probably a commercial competitor, Kaplan and Kraplin, for those who go way back in this field. And then, you know, provide the proof of the disruption and, to the extent you can, any actual consumer confusion. To the extent you can put it out there, it's the extent that the URS examiner can do a really rapid review of this. And four, again, adding you've attracted for commercial gain Internet users to your online location by intentionally creating the confusion. This is the passing off section, and we've just tried to strengthen it. This is intentional confusion. This is the WIPO situations that we were hearing about, the pharmaceuticals. If you're out there marketing a pharmaceutical, or even worse, a dangerous knockoff of a pharmaceutical, let's get those websites down as quickly as possible. Under C, the demonstration of rights and legitimate interests. We've, again, modified panelist to URS examiner. We've added a new one here, this first one. You have a credible and good faith belief that your use of the domain name is legitimate and legal. Again, going back to kind of the IRT forms, this seems to be what the IRT was envisioning in its form answer, that, you know, that you believe you have a correct use of this. We wanted to add here and make it explicit that that people are going to be coming to use words maybe even that they haven't been known by. The rest of the world is now coming online. We're breaking the artificial scarcity. And .com, and I know this because I came in at the beginning of, you know, the .com disputes 12, 13 years ago. In .com, there was a sense that there were already people there. This was space that was already occupied. But now we're opening up new space. This is the new, in these new top-level domains, this will be the space for the new brands, the new companies, the new groups, the new ideas. When people come online, they may not have a reason for why they chose the name other than that they really like it and it's an ordinary word and it seems fairly descriptive of what they're doing. So we thought, let's invite people to make their case as clearly as possible of why they think they should be here, why they think they're allowed to be here. And then everything else is just a slight modification of what's already in the UDRP.
Yes. Can I just jump in a little bit to just say a couple of things as well? The whole idea of this document was to reflect the UDRP elements, but at the same time adhere to what the IRT and the staff recommendation have been saying about raising the burden of proof. And Kathy was very correct in the beginning when she said that this we need to bear in mind that it has to be a little bit different compared to the UDRP, first of all, because this is a rapid suspension system, so the confusingly similar element will inevitably delay a little bit the process. So if we are expecting, for example, URS examiners to deliver their judgments very quickly, we cannot at the same time impose on them wording restrictions or restrictions that will stall a little bit this process. We have the UDRP for that. And at the same time, this takes into consideration the trademark concerns, which are very valid with those people who are registered multiple domain names or try to capitalize on someone else's fame. And these are mainly the situations where the UDRP has proven an ineffective system, but at the same time address also the legitimate concerns of the registrants who believe that they have a legitimate right or they have spent a lot of money and time on creating websites and they act in good faith. So it is an issue of creating this new process, but being also very balanced. So on the one hand, We are raising the limits, and we acknowledge that trademark owners under the URS will have to carry a different burden of proof compared to the UDRP, but at the same time, we also acknowledge the problem that exists out there.
So, Mike Rodenbach, can I get in the queue?
Can I make a comment before we go into the queue?
Have we lost our chair?
Yeah, definitely. Go ahead, Kathy, and then I got Mark and Mike.
I just wanted to apologize. I had switched over to a different screen. I was working off of the version Constantinos sent out that's completely redlined, and I just flipped back and realized that some of what I said might not have been clear. I should have been outlining much better what was deleted and what was added. I apologize. And urge everyone to go to the version Constantinos sent out just before the meeting.
Okay. Thanks for doing that, Constantinos. I've got Mark Partridge and then Mike Rodenbach.
Thanks, Jonathan. The first point I guess I want to make sure we're all on the same page about is where we were before in our discussions was that we would work from the UDRP elements and keep those and give some examples. That was where we ended the last conversation about this. This proposal changes the UDRP elements in significant and material ways. It's also a departure from the principles that were in the IRT, the idea of taking out confusingly similar. It was not the IRT's position that, or the staff's position. And if I can give just a quick example of why, there's probably other issues here, but if you only focus on identical marks, you miss most of what the problem is. I've got a court order here from the district court in Florida with 40 infringing names where the cyber squatters paid $100,000. And the marks are things like quickmastercard.com, rebatemastercard.com, www.mastercardbusinessad.com. All of these are used for pay-per-click sites or sites where they get affiliate fees from competitors. There's no dispute that these are the kinds of things that should be stopped quickly through the URS. Some might be phishing sites as well. But so that's a problem when you change the UDRP elements to take away the identical. Also, none of these are situations where this person is trying to sell the names to MasterCard. He's just engaged in a business where he registers variations of MasterCard over and over and over again, not primarily for sale, but for click-through revenue. Mm-hmm. That's an example of what this process is designed to go to, and I appreciate the goals of Kathy and Constantino's trying to come up with some examples. As I suggested before, I think the way to do it is to create safe harbors for good faith registrants. For example, as Constantino put it, that person who spends a lot of money and time creating a new site. That's something that they could submit their evidence and show on the answer, but I suggest that it's a problem to change the elements of the basic complaint, and that the way to look at this is to, as we discussed last time, is to create some safe harbors as defenses for the good faith registrants without minimizing and reducing the utility of this process.
I've got Mike and then Zahid.
I agree completely with pretty much everything Mark just said. To me, this is just kind of a non-starter to change the elements of the cause of action because of the confusion that would create in the community, not only in the IP community, but in the registrant community. I just don't see any reason why the standards should be different. I've always agreed that the burden of proof should be higher, and that's where we should be focusing, but not on changing the elements themselves.
Okay, I've got Zahid and then Paul McGrady.
Hi, yes, I appreciate the work that Kathy and Constantine have put into this, but the changing the elements from, identical and confusingly similar to identical, and a whole bunch of other things. For instance, I see that if you look at evidence of clear-cut abuse, it says the use of the domain name in bad faith and of clear-cut abuse, so you've raised that standard. You've talked about, if you look at this, it says significant number of domain names as opposed to one single domain name, so it has to be only a complaint with regard to multiple domain name abuses that you need to bring up. That would be an issue which is different. And basically, and I also see the last one, which is that the UDRP standard of without intent to commercial gain to misleading whatever consumers has been taken out. My understanding from reading the IRT report and also the staff report is that all of this stuff is still there. From taking this back to our members, for instance, and saying, well, we've watered it down beyond the staff report, I think Mike is absolutely right, would be a non-starter and very difficult for us to be able to explain why we're taking away confusing similar and many others. So just wanted to say that this is a tough sell for us, and it may be difficult. And just to agree with what everything Mark has said.
Okay, thanks, Zahid. So, Paul, you want to echo the same thing? Anything new to add to those three comments?
Yeah, I think so. And without going through all the problems that this document creates, I'll give you one example, and then I'll move on. But for example, in the B1 with the significantly in excess of out-of-pocket expenses, the question there is what margin? Are we opening up a loophole where somebody registers 100,000 domain names and only wants to sell them for $10 more than we bought them for? That's still a really profitable business model if you can offload a bunch of his inventory and, would essentially escape liability under the URS. And so, I just went through this and found, 10 or 12 other that are sort of unintentional loopholes that this thing opens up. I think that, frankly, this is so far away from what we talked about on the last call, that I almost feel like I don't want to say that we shouldn't talk about it, because we should, we should always be able to talk about things, but it's just so far away that I'm concerned that this really is going to bog us down. This would take literally, weeks, I think, to talk through on these sorts of calls. And so is it possible for the team that did this to sort of go back and do what Mark suggested and what we talked about in the last call, which is instead of messing with the elements, instead write in examples under each for clarity purposes. So I ask, is that team willing to do that and take that approach? Or are we sort of really stuck with having to talk about this, because I'm just concerned that this is, there's just no way in the world we would get through this in a conference call format and within the time frame that we.
Tim, Alan.
It's despite what I think Jeff said earlier. Not all of us are lawyers. Not all of us are trademark lawyers. And it would have made this a lot easier if we saw a true red line to understand what the changes were. I'm a little bit at a loss to even contribute to this discussion, because I really can't evaluate what the changes were that were made.
Constantine has sent out a true red line, but it was right before the call.
Okay, sorry, I didn't download that.
No, it was very late.
I've been on one conference call after another today. Yeah. Looking at that, it may make it a little bit better. It sounds like this is a pit that we're going to go into that we're not going to get out of, given the time frame we have right now. And I wonder to what extent can we take this offline. Try to have something presented next week, which is closer to a consensus.
Konstantinos.
Yes, I don't have a problem taking this offline. The only thing that I would like to bring to everybody's attention, because we heard what the example that Paul gave, which is actually a valid example, but the flip side of that as well, is that under UDRP panels, we have heard repeatedly that all the trademarks that have attached the .sax suffixed and they're used for criticism sites are confusingly similar. And I wouldn't like, for example, to have to create a system whereby I would bar or we would bar those domain names that in the eyes of some panelists or examiners might be confusingly similar. So this was an attempt to capture also all these cases whereby in, under the UDRP, confusingly similar has been interpreted as almost meaning anything.
Okay. So from a wearing the registrar hat, I think we would agree with some of the comments we've heard so far that this isn't the right time to do this. This I would think that these elements should be reviewed along with the UDRP and the URS during the mandatory review process, and that this process, you know, it was a specific decision that we made on the IRT not to get into the elements because we think it would be Pandora's box, which it appears that it is, and that we're not going to get consensus on changing the elements at this point. With that said, it might be worthwhile for folks, you know, precursor to the mandatory review to start discussing some of these issues because they're very meaty and very important, and it's not like we won't agree with some of these changes when the time comes. We just don't think the time is right at this point. I've got Kathy and then Jeff.
Okay, thank you. What you say makes sense, but I just wanted to add that we were asked to do this, and accordingly we invested a lot of time to do it. And last week we didn't have it because there were flus among our group and illnesses and other things. But I would hope that we don't dismiss this right now. We were asked to bring in what to us is clear-cut abuse, and we'd like to know what it. And we went through some key questions, and this wasn't just me and Constantinos. This was a full NCSG effort with Wendy and Robin, and really going through our sense of what clear-cut abuse is, going through our discussions in Sydney and Seoul about the slam-dunk cases that had been talked about to us and trying to document them. So I'm sorry, the version that we're looking at online doesn't have the red line. You've got it from Constantinos. If people could go through it and we could talk about it at the next meeting, it might be more fruitful because I know you're looking at it kind of cold right now, and that's not fair either.
Okay. Jeff.
2 points. One, I just want to echo from registrar point of view to agree with your statements, John. And I just had a question about, I guess, some of the terms that are used where people are saying, hey, let's take this offline, or, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, does that mean let's discuss it off on the list and let's keep this in part of it, or let's shelf this and not include it as part of the discussions? I mean, I appreciate, Kathy, the work that you and Constantinos, everyone did on this in the week, but I'm not sure if, you know, if looking at it, just now that we have this in front of us, maybe it does open up such a Pandora's box that it's maybe we all agree to not include it now. I'm unclear of the terms when people are saying let's, you know, take it offline, put it on the shelf. What sort of, can we sort of have an agreement about what are the next steps here? I mean, is it going to be discussed just on the list, or, you know, if someone could help me out with that.
Alan.
Before we end, we need to discuss what our deadlines are, but just as a little bit of an insight to it from the GNSO meeting yesterday, we have one more meeting on this before we have to deliver a report. So I think we have to factor in that time. What I meant offline was someone from NCSG and someone from the IPC or whatever to get together and try to come to some common ground. That's what I meant by offline in this particular case.
Okay, thanks. Super clear. I was just a question of just if someone could clarify that. Thank you.
Okay, so let's move on. Unless Paul, you have a last. No, good. Thanks, Paul. Let's just continue to go through the list. And if folks want to take that issue offline in the way that Alan recommended, that would be great. So we're going to continue to go through the straw man proposal. We're on format of the complaint. It looks like there's consensus on that. Standard for evaluation, consensus. Stop me if anyone disagrees with this. I'm just reading through the staff notes. Mode of notice, consensus. Notice contents, looks like there's consensus on that.
No, Alan?
Alan, go ahead.
Yeah. I certainly did not agree to the terms without change to without requiring change to who is. I mean, I'm not saying whether we need a new element in who is or we need a formatting of an existing text element, but ultimately we are not going to be able to fix the language issue without some change either to who is or to a registrar's database that backs it up.
I wholly disagree with that. I mean, you could have notices in different languages. You don't have to...
The question is, do we have to know what language to use for a given registrar?
Well, you could have standard languages. You could have the notices, just like you do when you go to a website. We have the different flags or something like that. But to your point is, you're looking for a deletion of without requiring changes to who is.
It's
a matter of policy.
I'm saying we could certainly say we would want to minimize that, but I wouldn't want to tie staff's hands on requiring that if ultimately that is the only way that we can meet the long-term goals. Remember, we're doing this whole thing in front of the world. We're claiming to be a multinational organization, an organization with presences in many places and in many lands, and we're going to be using IDNs. We are going to have to address the language issue, even if we don't know how to do it, in November 2009.
Okay. Any other comments on notice? So would you agree that there's consensus if you deleted that clause? Without requiring changes to who?
I would be happy with that, yes.
Okay, next one. Upon passing, effective filing a complaint for the initial freeze. That's consensus. All right, time to answer. Any more discussion on that? Any offline discussions happen during the week? So we have 20 days, 14 days, or 14 days with a 7-day extension.
It's Alan. I have a quick analysis of it.
Sure.
The original IRT said 14 days, and then I don't remember if the report said or people said that there was an expectation that a judgment would be rendered within 14 days, which meant the website might be taken down as quick as within 28 days. But what's being proposed here is 20 days and a much quicker judgment. You know, certainly less than we're targeting 3 working days and hopefully less than a working week. So we're meeting the end. We're meeting the same end deadline as in the IRT report, just by juggling where the boundary is between.
Right. So you're giving the response
between the
time.
Answer.
Yeah.
So I, from my point of view, this sounds like it meets the original. The original target without, softening when the website might come down.
Okay. Anyone care to respond? Is everyone comfortable with the 20 days now, understanding that we're putting the burden on the examination to go a lot faster than at least we in the IRT anticipated? Okay. That's Mark Partridge. So close, Mark.
Sorry, I have too many buttons to push here.
There, I got it. Am I on?
You're yep. on.
Oh, okay, now I can hear. Okay. I'm really worried, though, about this being a creep for longer and longer times, and want to emphasize that we're dealing with stuff that should really come down very, very fast. So, you know, if the 20 days is tied to an examination within 3 days, that doesn't seem too problematical. But if we get 20 days and then there's creep on longer and longer things, then I think this procedure is a problem.
Okay.
I would support that. That was Alan.
And that could be one of the metrics in the review.
Good point.
Okay. Commencement of evaluation. Again, the goal would be approximately...
It's Alan. I have a question. I'm assuming that if indeed the registrant responds in 4 days, the examiner doesn't have to wait the full 20. Is that correct?
That would be my understanding, right? Mark?
I'd suggest a system that this is done online, and as soon as everything is on file or the deadline is run, that the examiner... gets a notice that the case is ripe for review.
Yeah. No, I'm just verifying that. Yes, yeah. in the case of a default, we have to wait the full number of days. But if there is indeed an answer, the process does go ahead. I'm Just verifying that that's indeed the way it's envisioned.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, commencement of evaluation, again, 3 business days. I think there was some email traffic between Kurt and folks, or at least discussion on the call. The staff implementation said that 3 days might prove difficult. I think Mark made a statement that did staff back down on that, or is that where are we on the, on that? I don't know if Kurt's on the call or Margie.
Oh, actually, my question related to the prior thing. Where did we end up on the time to answer? I just want to make sure we accurately describe it in the notes.
20 days.
I believe Kurt's on the call.
You just threw him under the bus, didn't you?
I don't know the answer to the question.
I mean, we list it as a goal. It's not a requirement, so I guess it would be an implementation issue for staff to deal with.
John, this is Amy.
Uh-huh. Go ahead, Amy. Thanks.
Yeah, I think that's the key. I mean, Mark obviously knows a little bit better, having been a panelist for UDRP in terms of timing, et cetera. But I think it's something that we would certainly want to talk to when we get to, you know, putting in implementation with the providers, just to confirm that that is a doable deadline.
So the way it's worded, it looks like there's a consensus that, you know, that's the goal, and the hope is that, you know, the providers will be able to do that. And based on Mark's comments, it's not unrealistic to think that they would be able to do that.
Yeah, that's right. This is Kurt. Yeah, we'd make it a very specific request in the solicitation for service providers. And, you know, if they weren't able to do that 100% of the time, it would have to be specifically balanced against other needs, for example, quality or, you know, or consistency or something like that.
Okay. Number of examiners.
Just before you go, John, I was just going to add a real quick comment that the UDRP, as it's currently run, is not our best model. I'd say look at what the American Arbitration Association does with handling online cases, or actually what ICANN does with the nominating committee review of statements of interest. Those models are online, and you can look at them as soon as things are posted.
Okay. Number of examiners is consensus. Assignment of examiners. So where are we on that? Wasn't there a subgroup working on that issue? Kathy?
There was. Mark and I circulated some language about randomization of examiners across within providers, and also that this idea of certification, that everyone be trained as a URS examiner. And I think in light of our detailed discussions here, that's a very, very good idea that URS examiners be trained. And then the whole goal of preventing the forum shopping, that we don't want URS providers to kind of pick URS examiners who are going to come up with solutions on one side. And if we randomize it, particularly across providers, administratively there's nothing new here because UDRP providers do the 3-judge panels, and they work with panelists outside of their immediate community, outside of their own panelists all the time. So there's administrative precedent for this. And it achieves the fairness goal that NCSG is so concerned about. And with this kind of randomization across of panelists, the certification that everyone who qualifies gets to become a panelist and can be included within the randomization process. Now, with that, we can go kind of for the mandatory of the URS, because this is kind of a critical element of the fairness and due process.
Okay, Alan, and then Mark.
2 points. Number one, I thought we agreed we wouldn't use the word random, but rather rotation or something like that. The second point is the comment, the notes ends in the letter B, and I don't know what the rest of the sentence is. I may have a comment once I know what it says.
Okay, any clarification on that?
Or is it only my version that says that?
I don't see where you're looking.
All right, maybe it's the way I printed it. I see what the problem is. Okay. Okay. Sorry, and then it does say full randomness may not make sense. Okay.
Let's see. I've got Mark.
I was going to suggest that based on what we heard last time, that we're coming around to the view that the proposal that Kathy and I floated with some acknowledgement of what Alan had said about, first of all, not random, but perhaps blind rotation, taking into account needs for language and jurisdiction and the ability of providers to dismiss, for lack of a better word, bad panelists. not meaning that they're bad on the merits, but that they don't do their job. They don't meet the deadlines. They don't respond, etc. They're not doing their job. That it seemed like we had consensus on that overall concept.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Okay. It sounds like you just said what Paul wanted to say because he just pulled himself off. So any other comments on this one? All right, so what's the next step exactly, Mark and Kathy? Do you have more work to do? Or
I don't think we have any more work to do if the staff can write up what we've, that final point.
Okay. Great.
Great.
Success. Okay. Evaluation on the merits. There was consensus. Let's skip the next one. Because that'll have a fair amount of discussion, just and then we'll come back to it. Effective filing after default. The note is consensus that needs clarification in implementation. Anything more on that? Okay, Marge, are you comfortable with? Does anything in the text need to change?
Actually, I don't recall why that was in the note. Maybe someone on the call recalls why there needed to be clarification. I just don't recall.
Okay. Anyone? Okay, let's just mark that consensus then.
Wait, John, yeah, that was my... It's Jeff. Yeah, I don't remember that there were any issues on there, so I think that one was marked as consensus.
Okay, great. Appeal decision...
Sorry, John, I had to go away for a second. The only question I had on effects of filing is it doesn't say there that the website goes down or is brought back up if someone files an answer after default, which I think was the intent.
Yeah, could you clarify that, Marjorie, in the next round?
Yeah, I can clarify that. Thank you.
So it comes back up. Okay. All right, next issue, appeal. So I said there was clarification. It's not in all cases either party has a right to de novo review in the UDRP. The complainant has a right to go to the UDRP or court for de novo review. The respondent has a right to go to court, not the UDRP. So there's the URS appeal for either party, there's UDRP or a court for a complainant, and court for a respondent.
In those
consensus.
Courts where the respondent might have access.
Right. A court of competent jurisdiction, I guess.
But this is...
Go ahead, Kathy.
But just many people, we in the United States, we have access for an appeal because of the Anti-Cyber-Squatting Act. It's just important to keep in mind the vast majority of registrants don't have access to their courts, or so we've been told, because there is no cause of action. There's no legislation creating a cause of action for them.
Really? Mike Rodenbaugh, I mean, wouldn't that just be some sort of conversion theory? Fraud theory? I'd love
Mark,
to have some more detail on that, Kathy. I don't understand.
Mark, this is Martinos, and I can assure you that only the ACA has a separate cause of action for registrants. Under all the other national jurisdictions, registrants don't have a valid cause of action. Unless, of course, they have registered their domain name as a trademark. But unless that happens, they do not have a cause of action. And I have to be... the fact that we are giving the trademark owner two possibilities, the UDRP and the court, and we only give the court, which is expensive and slow, to the respondent, I would think that is problematic and it's unfair.
I actually agree with you on that, Constantino. Mike Rodenbaugh again, just for the record. I don't know if the IRT talked about this or not. I guess I don't particularly care. But has anybody thought about the idea of you know, having an appeal actually go to another panelist in the URF? So that whole scenario, was there any work done on that aspect yet?
No, we are, just to clarify, we are talking here that anyone, either side, has a right to appeal in the URS. In addition to whatever other rights they may have in the UDRP or in the Court of Competent Jurisdiction.
So they'll appeal the URS how and to whom?
That's the next item.
Got it.
Okay. All right, I've got Wendy. Again, we've got 8 minutes, so I've got Wendy, Paul, Mark, and Alan. Wendy, still there? Okay, Paul?
Yes.
Hello?
Hi.
Wendy's back. Okay, go ahead,
okay.
Wendy. Sorry, Paul.
Sorry about that. I thought we were creating an appeal panel within the URF as
we are.
And below. And so then this discussion above seems contradictory. I wouldn't think we would give the complainant appeal within the URF and appeal within the UDRP, but rather send everybody either through the URF, and if they were dissatisfied with that, directly out to court.
Well, I don't think we're in a position to mandate that they can't go to UDRP.
Sure we can. We can say in creating this new procedure that you get one bite at the ICANN arbitration apple, and if you've chosen URS instead of UDRP, then your only option is appeal within URS. I think we can say that. In creating.
No, but we've already said it's a different threshold, so.
Yep.
That would be, you would make the URS. You would just make the URS meaningless. Why would anybody use it?
Because they want rapid takedown, and because they have an appeal within that process, so they have two tries to make to get the panelist.
But the appeal would be at the higher.
Right. And
sorry.
If they fail at that.
All right, Paul.
I think what we're trying to say here is that there's not an appeal to the UDRP. There is no claim preclusion. In other words, if you bring or defend under the URS, that there's no claim preclusion, meaning you know we're not blocking your access to the UDRP process. We're not blocking your access to whatever remedies there are for you under national legislation and with your courts. You know, there is a process under the ACPA for folks who have access to the U.S. courts, whether they're residents or whether they simply have do it on reverse domain name hijacking. Whether or not, you know, such provisions exist for others in other jurisdictions may or may not be, you know, a bad outcome. But, again, we're just the STI. We're not in a position to legislate for other people. And so I think that this really is, if we go down this path and essentially carve out the access to the UDRP process, we're essentially, as someone mentioned, providing, you know, agreeing to a URS that nobody's going to use, and any URS that nobody's going to use is essentially, you know, no URS. So again, like the dramatic proposed changes to the proposed elements of the URS. I really think that we need to stay focused on what we've been talking about and all the calls leading up to today's call, and not to go so wildly off track and just sort of deal with what we have you know, before us, which is, you know,
okay. Yeah, no, go ahead.
The procedure of appeal.
Right. Okay, so let's look at the evaluation of the appeal, because that might help, if that's okay with folks, that might help move this along, because we only have a couple minutes. So, you know, reading the transcript, it looks like folks were not comfortable with the naming a three-member panel based on fair use, academic, trademark law expertise, but really wanted each side to pick one and then maybe have a third one, a neutral, for lack of a better term. Is anyone uncomfortable with a typical AAA or American Arbitration Association or JAMS or one of the bigger arbitration panels, that each side picks one and then there's a third one? Or there's the default of, you know, one ombudsperson that I can't put in there. A three-member panel is going to be a lot more expensive. That's the other issue to the appealing party.
John, this is Amy. Just to clarify, the ombudsman part was something that the IRT had recommended, and our indication was that that was something that would be requiring additional review and consideration. So not necessarily something that we were recommending out of.
Okay, but that's in the default. If we don't reach consensus, that's
Well, the proposal actually indicated that it would be something that would require further consideration.
Got it. Okay. Thanks for that clarification, Amy.
John?
Yeah, go ahead.
I raised the point last time, and I'm not sure where it got put, that given the rapid review process, it seemed like a standing appellate board might be appropriate here. Because this whole time frame in the review doesn't have the same time frame as the UDRP, so that having standing experts, so that the appeals can go just as quickly.
So that would be akin to what we have in ICANN World right now for the new registry service, the funnel process, where they have a standing panel of experts that would look at a new registry service to see if there's any security and stability issues with that. So that might be an analogy we could use. Any thoughts on that? I've got Mark.
Well, my thought is, again, I think as much as we can follow existing practices that are working, we're in good shape. The idea of having a three-member panel to review something is similar to what seems to work pretty well within arbitration and in the UDRP process, where the sides pick, and on the appeal, at least I don't think we have as much of a time concern. We don't need to have as much of a rush on that happening. But I'm not dismissing what Kathy says. I'm just wondering if we really need to come to a conclusion on that point, or if we can come to a consensus on the idea that it's a three-member panel. Review would be available, and that would consist of an existing appeal panel or a panel selected by the parties, just to try to move this forward.
Alan?
Yeah, I would just ask a simple question. I'm not sure if we discussed or if we need to discuss who pays for the appeal if the appealer wins.
So is there a cost shifting if the appeal is successful? Should the loser pay? Okay. Question. Okay, so obviously we're out of time now. We have our call tomorrow. I was not on the clearinghouse call last week either. Do you think we'll have extra time? Because we still have the one issue that we did skip on what happens in a successful URS complaint. So we have that issue out there that I know is important to Mike and the VC, so I don't want to shortchange that. And from Alan's update, sounds like we don't have much time altogether in this process from the GNSO perspective.
Yeah, I'd like to take either I or Zahid should take a minute and just say what was decided yesterday.
Yeah, go ahead. Thanks.
Okay. The GNSO next meets on the 17th. We have acknowledgement from staff that the board will accept a 3-day delay.
So our target is to get something to the GNSO to allow a decision to be made at the meeting on December 17th. Our target is that we should have a report to the GNSO, preferably by the 7th of December, which is a Monday, or at worst, 2 or maybe 3 days later, but to at the very least give the councillors a week to consult with their constituency stakeholder group to instruct them how to vote, if that's appropriate. So we need a report essentially 2 weeks from yesterday, if I have the timing proper. And so we're going to have to, sometime next week, start putting together some drafting teams, or maybe at the end of this week, to start putting together some drafting teams to draft what we have consensus of, and approve it at our last meeting, which is likely to be the next week in each of the two cases. Or maybe we want a third meeting next week to discuss the actual text documents to pass them on to the GNSO. In any case, our target is we're supposed to be delivering something roughly 2 weeks from today.
Why is what the staff is taking notes on not what we have drafted?
I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying that at some point we have to pass it on to the GNSO, and that point is roughly 2 weeks from today. So
yeah, I agree with Wendy. I don't think we need a full-blown report, but we could give them even a bullet point. Or
I wasn't trying to say otherwise, just that we need something that we can say we're signing off on.
Right. Okay, so the point is we will have one, maybe two at best, meetings before we just have to pull the trigger. But it doesn't sound like we're all that far apart, but we do have this one issue on the URS side. So the question again is, are folks okay adding some time or cutting out some time of the trademark stuff, clearinghouse stuff tomorrow to add this one issue, or will we have a full agenda on the clearinghouse stuff?
God knows.
Yeah. Okay.
One more thing is, it was clarified that should we not be able to come to consensus completely or on any given issues, the alternative is not the staff proposals as written on the document several months ago, but the board will factor in whatever we do come to consensus on, plus the, of course, the public comments that are coming in parallel.
Sure. Okay. Zahid?
Thank you. Thanks, John. One of the issues we've been discussing in the BC is that we're happy to get the process moving, and there's a lot of places we see the word consensus come up as we go through the URS. I mean, we have had concerns about, the 14 days or the 20 days. But if supposing we don't discuss and don't have consensus on the issue of the transfer, I think we will have to go back and say, well, there's a lot of things we don't have consensus on. So I don't want, just for the record, just because we're going through this process, shouldn't be taken as unconditional consensus as far as the VC is concerned if we don't have transfer, just to make that point for the record.
You don't have transfer or?
Transfer. Transfer domain name as a remedy.
As opposed to the 1 year that we had talked about? I know that there was some discussion about that yesterday with some last week.
That's right.
Concerns.
That's
so
right.
You're saying
transfer
is a gating item for you, for the BC?
Well, I mean, we need to discuss it. We need to come to some consensus on that, because it basically triggers many of the other issues we've been discussing. Like, we've been letting go on a lot of issues. I'm sure other people have as well. But, I mean, it really is a gating issue for us.
Yeah, I would, ask that you guys go back and talk about that and talk to maybe the IPC folks. Sure was not.
Well, John, okay. Mike Rodenbach, we have talked to the IPC folks, and we have discussed this internally. And our very strong position is that this is an entire waste of time if there's not a transfer remedy at the end.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that opinion.
Okay. It's Alan. I have some thoughts on that, but I'll put them on the mailing list.
Yeah. Okay. If we could take that, and maybe we could get some discussion on that issue. Okay. And then I guess we're reconvening tomorrow. I'm not sure the exact time for everyone, what the UTC time is. Anyone know that?
Hold on.
10:30 Eastern.
10:30 Eastern. So whatever, Eastern in the U.S. I'm not sure what that equates to.
15 PC.
Okay.
Will there be a new straw man coming out?
Can I say one more?
Yeah.
So in terms of next week, should we go ahead and send a doodle out for 3 days? Is that what we're suggesting? I just want to make sure we get that on everyone's calendar given the holiday.
Yeah, I would think, you know, Monday and Tuesday, if we could do that, we're
okay.
Going to need to.
And do you want to tentatively schedule a third that we might cancel if we don't need it, or just the 2 days?
Yeah, if folks are willing, we could do Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday or something. I know it's a big commitment. Or maybe we have a shorter one.
Okay, well, and we can always cancel. So, if we could do this quicker, we can cancel some of those calls.
Yeah, and then tomorrow, are we expecting a new straw man on the clearinghouse?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll try to send it out earlier than I did today.
Okay, well,
Margie?
Yeah.
Can you send out the spreadsheets not protected?
I don't know how that happened, but,
okay.
But I'll try.
Yeah, because it's nice to be able to make a note on it or highlight a box that we want to talk about.
So,
sure.
Margie, thanks for all your time in pulling those together. I know it's not easy, so I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Right. Well, thanks everyone, and we'll talk tomorrow.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thanks, John, for moderating.
Right.
Thank you, Ed.